On Monday morning, March 6, 1944, foul smoke poured from the chimney of a stylish home at 21 Rue Le Sueur, Paris. Neighbors suspiciously eyed the three-story, 19th-century house, with its private stable and courtyard, once the home of a lesser French princess. As the hours, then days, dragged on with no abatement of the noxious smoke, a neighbor finally went to complain on Saturday, March the 11th. He found a note tacked to the door. Away for 1 month. Forward mail to 18 Rue des Lombards in Auxerre. Police were summoned, and a pair of officers arrived on bicycles. Neighbors informed them that the house owner, Dr. Marcel Petiot, maintained a separate residence 2 miles away at 66 Rue Comartin. Some noted the mysterious parade of callers at Dr. Petiot's empty house during the past 6 months, including nightly visits from a stranger with a horse cart. Some months earlier, two trucks had stopped at number 21, the first removing 47 suitcases, while the second delivered 30 or 40 heavy sacks of something unknown. The officers telephoned Dr. Petiot at home. He asked whether they had entered the house, and upon receiving a negative reply, he cautioned, "Don't do anything. I will be there in 15 minutes. A half hour later, with the smoke worsening and no sign of Petiot, the patrolman called for firefighters. Entering through a second-story window, firemen searched the upper floors before entering the basement. They soon emerged, one vomiting, their chief telling the cops, "You have some work ahead of you." Three officers next went downstairs, where a coal-fed stove was found burning full blast, a human arm dangling from its open door. Nearby, a heap of coal was mixed with human bones and fragments of several dismembered bodies. It was impossible to count the victims in this tableau of grisly disarray. Stunned, police left the basement at about the time Dr. Petiot arrived on his bicycle. "This is serious," Petiot remarked. "My head could be at stake." Then, after questioning each lawman to ascertain that they were French, Petiot identified the basement dead as "Germans and traitors to our country." Petiot claimed to be the head of a resistance group with 300 files at home on Rue Comartin, which must be destroyed before the enemy finds them. The French policeman, embittered by years of Nazi occupation, allowed Petiot to leave. 7 months would pass before they saw him again. Meanwhile, a search of the death scene proceeded. In Petiot's garage, police found a large heap of quicklime mixed with human remains, including a recognizable scalp and jawbone. A pit had been dug in the stable, filled with more quicklime and corpses in various stages of decomposition. On the staircase leading from the courtyard to the basement, police found a canvas sack containing the headless left half of a corpse, complete but for its foot and vital organs. Commissaire Georges-Victor Massu, a 33-year-old police veteran with more than 3,200 arrests to his credit, immediately took charge of the case. Examining the death house, he noted basement sinks large enough for draining corpses of blood and a soundproof octagonal chamber with wall-mounted shackles, a peephole centered in its door. Massu was still on the scene at 1:30 a.m. when a telegram arrived from Paris police headquarters. It read, "Order from German authorities. Arrest Petiot. Dangerous lunatic." To French patriots, that order from German invaders suggested Petiot might indeed be a hero of the resistance. Police dragged their feet on the way to Rue Comartin and found Petiot's apartment abandoned, no trace of the doctor or his family. Rather than search for him, detectives grilled the workman who had remodeled the house on Rue Le Sueur. When Parisian authorities learned that Petiot had been jailed and tortured by the Gestapo from May 1943 until January 1944, it eliminated the rationale for an urgent manhunt. Back at Rue Le Sueur, searchers collected mutilated remnants of at least 10 victims. However, Chief Coroner Albert Paul told reporters that the number 10 is vastly inferior to the real one. In addition to identifiable bones and body parts, Dr. Paul catalogued 33 pounds of charred bones, 24 pounds of unburned fragments, 11 pounds of human hair, including more than 10 whole scalps, and 3 garbage cans full of pieces too small to identify. Based on the substantial pieces, Paul said the oldest victim was a 50-year-old man, the youngest a 25-year-old woman. None bore any knife or gunshot wounds, nor had they been poisoned with any toxic metal. Organic poisons could not be ruled out from the samples in hand. At Petiot's apartment on Rue Caumartin, police found quantities of chloroform, digitalis, strychnine, and other poisons, plus 50 times a typical physician's stock of heroin and morphine. Clearly, there was something odd about Dr. Petiot, but he was gone. Patriot or villain, he had slipped away, leaving police with three questions. Who were the victims of 21 Rue Le Sueur? How did they die? And where was Dr. Petiot? A police review of Petiot's background helped identify two victims from the 21 Rue Le Sueur slaughterhouse. One was Jean-Marc Van Bevey, a Paris drug addict who procured his narcotics from Dr. Petiot until February 1942, when Van Bevey was jailed in a crackdown on pharmacies trading in illicit drugs. Van Bevey admitted buying fraudulent prescriptions from Petiot, but he vanished days before his March 1942 trial. At the time, police believed underworld associates likely murdered Van Bevey, but they reconsidered that judgment 2 years later in light of their discoveries on Rue Le Sueur. Another victim was identified as Martha Cait, the mother of another addict, one Raymond Baudet, who also bargained with Petiot for her poison of choice. Baudet had been jailed in March 1942, 2 weeks before Van Bevey disappeared, and Petiot had come to Martha Cait with an idea to help himself get off the hook. He suggested that Mrs. Cait could lie under oath, claiming that some of Raymond's prescriptions, written in her mother's surname, really belonged to Martha, thereby weakening the prosecution's case against Petiot. Cait agreed, then had a change of heart after consulting her physician. She vanished on March 26th. Later, her husband received two letters declaring Martha's intention to leave the country. The husband consulted Petiot, who confirmed Martha's plan to escape Nazi-occupied France. Unconvinced, Raymond Baudet reported her mother missing on May 7, 1942, but no trace of Martha was found until officers searched 21 Rue Le Sueur. In July 1942, Petiot was convicted in both narcotics cases. He was fined 10,000 francs for each offense, but the fine was reduced on appeal to a total of 2,400 francs. Inspector Roger Ginoux suspected Petiot of murdering Cait and Van Bevey, but he had no proof that either victim was dead until March 1944. By that time, Petiot had disappeared. The search for Petiot began in earnest on March 13, 1944. His wife and son were questioned in Paris, along with his brother Maurice. Maurice Petiot, lacking his brother's gall or cunning, soon confessed that he had delivered the quicklime to 21 Rue Le Sueur, acting on Marcel's orders. Charged with conspiracy to commit murder, Maurice was jailed on March 17th. Georgette Petiot was also detained, suspected of aiding husband Marcel in his crimes. German commissaire Robert Judcombe provided the motive for Petiot's murders, along with details of Petiot's eight-month imprisonment by the Gestapo. Petiot had been arrested in May 1943, along with three others, on suspicion of smuggling Jews out of occupied France. Casting their net for witnesses, police found a Paris resident who planned to flee but changed his mind. Marcel Petiot, he said, had offered passage to South America with all required travel papers for 25,000 francs. One who used Petiot's service and vanished forever was Joachim Gushinov, a Jewish furrier. When he disappeared in January 1942, Gushinov took some 500,000 francs in cash, five sable coats, plus gold, silver, and diamonds worth as much as 700,000 francs. Once the escape network was exposed, the police had no difficulty capturing Petiot's accomplices. A childhood friend of Petiot's, René Gustave Nézondet, was arrested on March 17, 1944. A friend of Nézondet's picked up the same day, Roland Porchon, admitted referring clients to Nézondet and Petiot. In July 1942, Porchon told detectives that Nézondet described Petiot as the king of criminals, claiming that he had seen 16 corpses stretched out in the basement of 21 Rue Le Sueur. A second witness recalled Nézondet's admission that he had helped Petiot hide bodies. Nézondet, for his part, initially denied the charges, then confessed on March 22nd. He had a different chronology for the story, though, claiming that he first learned of the slaughter on Rue Le Sueur in November or December 1943, when Petiot was in Gestapo custody. Besides the corpses, he had also seen a diary, now missing, which listed the names of 50 or 60 victims. Six others were arrested in the Petiot manhunt, including a barber who referred clients to Petiot from his shop on Rue des Mathurins, and Albert and Simone Neuhausen, who were held for receiving stolen property after they confessed that they helped remove suitcases from 21 Rue Le Sueur. Most of the suspects were released in April 1944, though Nézandet remained in custody for 14 months. Marcel Petiot was still a fugitive on June 6, 1944, when Allied troops invaded France and the investigation ground to a halt. Marcel-André-Henri Félix Petiot was born in Auxerre, 100 miles south of Paris, on January 17, 1897. Neighbors later told many stories of his bizarre childhood, but it is unclear how many were fabricated for the press. He enjoyed torturing small animals to death, they said. His early teachers found Petiot intelligent, reading like a 10-year-old by age 5, but he was also a loner with a short attention span. Precociously lewd, he once propositioned a male classmate for sex and was caught passing obscene photos to other students. At age 11, he stole his father's revolver and fired it in history class. He also staged a circus act at school, standing a friend against a door and throwing knives at him. Of course, Petiot's parents were concerned. Between 1907 and 1909, they told physicians that Marcel was prone to convulsions and sleepwalking, and habitually wet his trousers and bed. Petiot's mother died in 1912, and his father took a job in Joigny, 15 miles from Auxerre. Marcel and Maurice lived with an aunt until Marcel was expelled from school near year's end. Sent to stay with his father, Petiot was soon expelled from a Joigny school for unruly behavior and overexcitation. Petiot soon graduated from childhood mischief to criminal behavior. At age 17, he robbed a postbox and was then charged with mail theft and damaging public property. The court recommended a psychological evaluation. On March 26, 1914, a psychiatrist pronounced Petiot an abnormal youth suffering from personal and hereditary problems, which limit to a large degree his responsibility for his acts. It was enough to get the charges dropped in August, Petiot's judge declaring that the accused appears to be mentally ill. A pattern was forming. Petiot was expelled twice more from schools in Dijon and Auxerre, before finally completing his education in Paris at a special academy in July 1915. World War I was in progress, and Petiot was drafted into the French infantry in January 1916, dispatched to the front that November. While fighting in the Aisne district 6 months later, Petiot was gassed and wounded by grenade fragments. The wounds healed, but Petiot displayed mental illness symptoms that sent him to a series of clinics and rest homes. Charged with stealing army blankets, he was jailed at Orléans, then transferred to a psychiatric ward at Fleury-les-Aubrais. Doctors diagnosed Petiot as suffering from mental disequilibrium, neurasthenia, mental depression, melancholia, obsessions, and phobias. Once again, they ruled him not guilty by reason of insanity. The diagnosis did not keep him out of military service, however. Returned to the front in June 1918, Petiot promptly suffered a nervous breakdown and shot himself in the foot. Transferred behind the lines, he displayed convulsions at the Dijon railway depot in July, lying unconscious for most of the day. That episode earned him a 3-week leave, but he was attached to a new regiment in September 1918. Erratic behavior and complaints of headaches sent him back for psychiatric treatment at Rennes in March 1919. This time, the diagnoses added were amnesia, sleepwalking, depression, and suicidal tendencies. It was finally enough to get him out of uniform. He was discharged with a 40% disability pension in July. Petiot's case was reviewed in September 1920, with his disability rating increased to 100%. The author of that report suggested that Petiot be committed to an asylum. In fact, Petiot had already entered a mental hospital, but not as a patient. Aided by an accelerated education program for war veterans, he had completed medical school in a stunning 8 months and served a 2-year psychiatric internship at Évreux. He received his medical degree on December 15, 1921, from the Faculté de Médecine de Paris. Criminal insanity notwithstanding, Petiot had become a full-fledged physician. Armed with his new medical degree, Petiot moved to Villeneuve-sur-Yonne, an ancient village on the Yonne River, 25 miles from Auxerre. On arrival, the 25-year-old physician printed flyers comparing himself to the town's two elderly doctors. The flyers read, "Dr. Petiot is young, and only a young doctor can keep up to date on the latest methods born of progress, which marches with giant strides. This is why intelligent patients have confidence in him. Dr. Petiot treats, but does not exploit his patients." In fact, while outwardly charming and popular with most of his patients, Petiot secretly enrolled them for state medical assistance, thereby ensuring that he was paid twice for each treatment, once by the patient and once by the government. He favored addictive narcotics in his prescriptions. When one pharmacist complained of the near-fatal dose Petiot prescribed for a child, Petiot replied, "What difference does it make to you anyways? Isn't it better to do away with this kid who's not doing anything in the world but pestering its mother?" In private, Petiot remained a loner, who turned casual conversations into heated debates, ever insisting on the last word. He lived modestly, but splurged on a sports car he drove recklessly through Villeneuve-sur-Yonne, causing numerous traffic accidents. A confirmed thief, Petiot stole from strangers and relatives alike. Brother Maurice insisted on searching his pockets every time Marcel visited his home. Evicted by one landlord for theft of furniture and fixtures, Petiot shrugged off threats of litigation with the remark that, as a certified lunatic, he could never be convicted. Around the same time, in March 1922, Petiot clashed with the Commission de Réforme over demands for new psychiatric exams to maintain his disability payments. He declared that he purely and simply refused to accept any disability pension at all to avoid being subjected to what I find a more than disagreeable bit of exhibitionism. Still, the checks kept coming, and he was examined once more in July 1923. Doctors reporting that his tongue was scarred from bite wounds during epileptic seizures and that Petiot evinced total indifference about his future. That said, his disability was reduced to 50%. In 1926, Petiot surprised his neighbors by launching a torrid affair with young Louise Devalot, the daughter of Madame Fleury, an elderly patient. Soon after the affair began, the Fleury home was burglarized and set afire. No one connected the events, but Petiot was suspected when Louise disappeared in May 1926. Neighbors recalled seeing Petiot load a large trunk into his car, closely resembling another fished out of the river weeks later, filled with the dismembered, decomposing remains of a young woman who was never identified. Ignoring the coincidence, police searched briefly for Louise and then dismissed her as a runaway. She may, in fact, have been Petiot's first murder victim. Soon after Louise disappeared, Petiot ran for mayor of Villeneuve-sur-Yonne. The long, bitter campaign climaxed in July 1926 when Petiot hired an accomplice to disrupt a political debate with his opponent. When Petiot finished speaking, his crony cut power to the auditorium, blacking out the entire village and starting several fires. Petiot won by a landslide. His opponent later told the Commission de Réforme that Petiot had boasted of feigning insanity to escape military service. Yet another review of his case confirmed the original diagnosis, pronouncing Petiot's claims of fraud another manifestation of the subject's mentally unbalanced state. Villeneuve-sur-Yonne now had a certified madman in charge, and Petiot acted the part. His kleptomania was an open secret. Mayor Petiot was suspected of stealing money from the town's treasury, the bass drum from a local band, even a large stone cross that Petiot had once deemed an eyesore. Some despised Petiot. Others called him the best mayor ever. Petiot, for his part, blamed all criticism on crass political enemies. In June 1927, Petiot married Georgette Lablé, the 23-year-old daughter of a wealthy landowner in nearby Seignelay. Their only child, a son Gerhardt, was born the following April. 8 months after that happy event, Petiot was accused of stealing several oil cans from Villeneuve-sur-Yonne's railroad depot. As it turned out, Petiot had purchased the oil legally, but he did commit fraud by denying receipt of the shipment and claiming a refund. In early 1930, the court at Sens fined him 200 francs and sentenced him to 3 months in prison. Petiot was suspended as mayor for 4 months, but managed to have the conviction reversed on appeal. In the meantime, more serious trouble was afoot. One night in March 1930, fire razed the home of dairy unionist Armand Debove. His wife, Henriette, was found inside, beaten to death with a blunt instrument. Police suspected murder during a robbery, since 20,000 francs was reported missing from the house. Footprints led across the nearby field towards Villeneuve-sur-Yonne. Rumors spread that Henriette Debove was Dr. Petiot's mistress and that he was seen near her home on the night of the crime. In that case, the witness, a Monsieur Fiscot, declared his plans to testify but made a fateful visit to Dr. Petiot's office instead. Fiscot sought treatment for his rheumatism. He received an injection and died 3 hours later, Petiot signing the death certificate, blaming his demise on an aneurysm. In April, Armand Debove spoke to police, telling them that a resident of Villeneuve-sur-Yonne had claimed Dr. Petiot could identify Henriette's killer. Local gendarmes sought help from police headquarters in Paris, but the file was somehow misplaced, disappearing until April 1946. By that time, Dr. Petiot was charged with multiple murders in Paris, and no one seemed interested in reopening the Debove investigation. During the next 16 months, the local prefect logged numerous complaints against Mayor Petiot, most involving theft or financial irregularities. Prosecutors investigated, finding that 138 alien registration applications and 2,890 francs in fees had been held at City Hall, never relayed to the proper authorities. Petiot blamed his secretary, who obliged the mayor by accepting responsibility. But Petiot was still suspended as mayor for the second time in August 1931, and he resigned the next day. The village council also resigned in sympathy, leaving files in disarray and many purchase orders obviously altered. Petiot's mayoral office was officially revoked the next month, but he did not seem to mind. 5 weeks later, on October 18th, he won the election as the youngest of 34 general councillors from the Yonne district. As usual, his tenure was stormy, with Petiot accused of stealing electric power from the village of Villeneuve-sur-Yonne in August 1932. At trial on that charge the following year, the judge dubbed Petiot's defense pure fantasy and sentenced him to 15 days in jail and a 300 franc fine. The appeal dragged on for a year, affirming Petiot's conviction but suspending the jail time, with his fine reduced to 100 francs. The conviction cost Petiot his council seat, but it hardly mattered since he moved his family to Paris in January 1933. Petiot promoted himself with typical zeal in Paris, offering patients a wide variety of treatments, claiming both real and imaginary credentials. Advertisements described him as an intern at one mental hospital where he had actually been an interné, or a patient. Outside his home office at 66 Rue Comartin, Petiot erected a brass plaque so jam-packed with phony endorsements that another physician complained to the medical association and Petiot was forced to remove it. Bogus credentials aside, Dr. Petiot attracted a vast clientele and built an exemplary reputation. Years later, at the height of his infamy in 1944, police would interview 2,000 patients without hearing a word of criticism about Dr. Petiot. At the same time, however, rumors persisted that Petiot was an abortionist, which was illegal in those days, and that he supplied addicts with drugs under the guise of cures. In 1934, 30-year-old Raymond Aunes visited Petiot for treatment of an abscess in her mouth. She was still unconscious when Petiot drove her home after surgery. Aunes never regained consciousness and died several hours later. Her mother, Madame Anna Coquille, demanded an autopsy, which revealed significant levels of morphine in Raymond's body. The coroner postponed burial until a full investigation was completed, but authorities closed the case without filing charges. Madame Coquille renewed her complaints in 1942, but the court upheld its original finding of death by natural causes. Petiot faced his first investigation for narcotics violations in 1935, but police found no conclusive evidence. The next year, Petiot was appointed Médecin d'État Civil for Paris's 9th arrondissement, which granted him authority to sign death certificates. As usual, he used the position for personal gain. In December 1942, summoned to pronounce the death of a wealthy lawyer, Petiot was accused of stealing 74,000 francs from the dead man's home. Caught shoplifting a book in April 1936, Petiot assaulted a policeman and escaped on foot. He surrendered 2 days later, tearfully pleading for mercy, citing his military discharge records as proof that he was not responsible for his behavior. Police dropped the assault charge, and Petiot was acquitted of theft on grounds of insanity. His wife, Georgette, arranged for Petiot to enter a private sanatorium in August 1936. Petiot had barely arrived at the hospital when he began pleading for immediate release. His madness had passed, he assured staff psychiatrists. It was a momentary aberration caused by his preoccupation with a new invention, a suction machine designed to relieve constipation. Dr. Rogue de Fersac found Petiot chronically unbalanced, but still recommended his release in early September 1936. Petiot's liberation was nonetheless stalled while the court appointed 3 more psychiatrists to review his case. The panel's report expressed strong doubts as to Petiot's good faith at any point during this affair, but the doctors could find no legal grounds for holding him. Petiot was released in February 1937. Chastened by his latest confinement, Petiot appeared to clean up his act, with the exception of persistent tax fraud. Between 1937 and 1940, he reported less than 10% of his actual income. In 1938, for instance, he declared 13,100 francs, while earning closer to 500,000 francs. That year saw him charged with fraud and fined 35,000 francs, despite a spirited defense that included pleas of poverty. Every Frenchman's life changed in September 1939, when German troops invaded Poland, thus launching World War II. Polish resistance collapsed in October, inaugurating the 7-month phony war between France and Germany. Fighting spread with the Nazi invasion of Denmark and Norway in April. German troops invaded Holland, Belgium, and France the following month. The French commander of Paris declared it an open city in June 1940, and German troops seized the French capital. A collaborationist French government under Marshal Philippe Pétain was organized 2 weeks later in Vichy, broadcasting orders for a general ceasefire. 42,000 French soldiers surrendered on June 22nd, while the resistance armed and organized for long years of guerrilla war. In Paris, Dr. Petiot had a new world of opportunity under German occupation. He would use and emulate the Nazis in pursuit of his greatest and most lethal scheme thus far. There was, it seems, at least some truth to Petiot's later claims of joining the resistance. Soon after the Nazi occupation of Paris, he began providing false medical certificates to Frenchmen drafted for slave labor. Petiot also apparently treated sick and wounded workers returned to France from Germany, gleaning information about Nazi troop movements and weapons development. His Flytox network, named after a popular insecticide, since informers were dubbed flies, spied on Gestapo headquarters in Paris to identify collaborators so teams of resistance assassins could eliminate them. At the same time, though, Petiot spun tales of patriotic battles that were never fought. He claimed to have invented secret weapons that killed Nazis without forensic evidence. Allied commanders denied his reports of high-level meetings, and no evidence of the mysterious weapon ever surfaced. Petiot also claimed to be working with a group of anti-fascist Spaniards in Paris, but they were never found. His tales of planting bombs and booby traps around Paris were fervid flights of fantasy. Petiot's chief operation after 1940 was disclosing escape routes to potential fugitives. He welcomed Jews, resistance fighters, petty criminals, anyone who could meet his price of 25,000 francs a head. For that amount, Petiot promised safe passage to South America, complete with all the necessary travel papers. In 1941, he bought the house at 21 Rue Le Sueur as a way station for his personal underground railroad. Among Petiot's early customers were two Parisian pimps, Joseph Réaucreux and Adrien Estebetegui, who had lately broadened their repertoire to include armed robbery while disguised as Gestapo agents. Sought by French and German police alike, Réaucreux sought help from Petiot, known as Dr. Eugène to his illicit clients, in September 1942, traveling with his mistress, Claudia Chamoux, and another couple, pimp François Albertini and prostitute Annette Basset, Réaucreux paid his fee and promptly vanished into 21 Rue Le Sueur. Estebetegui and girlfriend Gisèle Rosny followed in March 1943, also vanishing without a trace. Petiot would later boast of killing the three pimps and their women, branding all six as Nazi collaborators, touting their executions as his patriotic duty. By April 1943, Gestapo officers reported a great deal of talk in public about an organization which alleges clandestine crossings of the Spanish border using falsified Argentinian passports. Nazis asserted that the voyagers travel on neutral ships leaving from a port in Portugal. In fact, they never left Paris alive. Gestapo agent Robert Judcombe blackmailed a French Jew, Yvonne Dreyfus, into approaching the network for passage, but Dreyfus vanished with the rest in May 1943. Others who availed themselves of Dr. Petiot's services included Nelly Denise Autain, a pregnant newlywed who came looking for an abortion in July 1941 and was never seen again. Dr. Paul-Léon Bromberger, an elderly Jew who planned to flee with his wife, disappeared alone from a Paris subway station in June 1942. A month later, three German Jews, the Nellers, vanished after consultations with Petiot. Their dismembered remains were fished out of the Seine in August. Three more refugees, the Wolf family, disappeared into 21 Rue Le Sueur along with six friends. Another pimp, Joseph Pierrechi, also made the dead-end journey with his mistress, Josephine Amé Grippe. Those were the victims whom police later identified, but they did not comprise the total body count. Numerous dismembered victims were dragged from the Seine in 1942 and 1943, the remains including nine heads, four thighs, and sundry other mutilated pieces. French police and coroners were baffled, unable to identify most of the dead. Gestapo agents, for their part, were less concerned about dead Frenchmen than about the prospect of Jews and resistance fighters escaping to freedom. The Nazis had a fix on Petiot's Flytox network, and by May 1943, they were ready to spring the trap. Petiot advertised his illicit services so blatantly that the Flytox network was ripe for infiltration by early 1943. In fact, an informer named Charles Beretta had wormed his way into the operation, feeding names to the Gestapo as he went. In May, Nazis arrested Raoul Fourier, Edmond Pintard, and René-Gustave Nézondet, torturing them until they identified Marcel Petiot as Dr. Eugène. Petiot joined the others in prisons at Fresnes. Although Nazis searched his home and other property, they somehow missed the charnel house on Rue Le Sueur. Nézondet was released 2 weeks later, but Petiot, Fourier, and Pintard spent a total of 8 months in prison. They were tortured repeatedly, but staunchly refused to betray members of the resistance. Based on the tales Petiot spun at his murder trial in 1946, his stubborn silence may have sprung from simple ignorance. The hero had no names to offer his captors, since he played no significant role in the resistance movement, and any confession of his Flytox operation was tantamount to suicide. Frustrated, the Nazis released Fourier, Pintard, and Petiot in early January 1944. Ironically, the months of torture and confinement provided Petiot with his best cover yet, but his time was running out. By March, his chamber of horrors on Rue Le Sueur was exposed, and Petiot himself had vanished. Loyal patients and friends were the key to Petiot's survival as a fugitive. They shuttled him from one address to another in Paris, while he cultivated a beard and adopted one name after another to conceal his movements. Eventually, Petiot found a home with patient Georges Redouté. Petiot convinced Redouté that the Gestapo wanted him for killing Germans and informers. While living with Redouté, Petiot ventured out only at night, sometimes returning with weapons claimed to have been captured from Nazi patrols. Parisian police went on strike in August 1944, besieged at their préfecture by German tanks and troops. That month, Petiot, calling himself Henri Valéry, joined the new French Forces of the Interior, the FFI. He was promptly commissioned as a captain in charge of counter-espionage and interrogation of prisoners in Paris's Rueil district. The French capital was liberated the next month and collaborators were purged, with Petiot Valéry in the thick of the action. His cover began to unravel in September when two FFI soldiers from Petiot's unit robbed the elderly mayor of Tessancourt, stealing 12.5 million francs in cash and collectible stamps from his home before killing their victim in front of witnesses. Three youths reported the crime to Petiot, who promptly tossed them in jail. An FFI lieutenant tried to investigate but was ordered off the case by Captain Valéry. The bandits were briefly detained, then released. The thieves disappeared, as well as the money. 3 days after the robbery murder, the newspaper Résistance published a scathing article on fugitive Petiot. The story called him a soldier of the Reich who had allegedly donned a German uniform to hunt down Avignon's French patriots in March 1943. Attorney René Fleuriot, Petiot's defense counsel in the 1942 narcotics cases, received a letter from his fugitive client which condemned the Résistance article as a collection of filthy kraut lies. While the letter was false, Petiot's letter convinced the authorities that he was still in Paris. A new search began, with FFI Captain Henri Valéry among the officers drafted to hunt for Petiot. Petiot's luck ran out at 10:15 a.m. on October 31st, when Petiot was recognized and arrested at a Paris metro station. He carried a pistol, 31,700 francs in cash, and 50 documents in six different names. Petiot's long run was over, but the search for the truth had just begun. Petiot's defense was a plea of complete innocence. He admitted killing certain enemies of France as a resistance member, but denied any murders for profit. According to Petiot, he first became aware of corpses stashed at 21 Rue Le Sueur in February 1944 after his release from Nazi custody. He assumed the dead collaborators had been killed and dumped by members of his Flytalks network, long since scattered and unable to verify his story. Petiot had asked brother Maurice for quicklime to dissolve the bodies and camouflage their odor. Petiot was housed on death row at Santé prison while authorities investigated his claims. Strangely, for a patriotic hero, he had no defenders in the leadership of recognized resistance groups. Some knew him as a small-time hanger-on, a fraud, or not at all. Other groups, described in detail by Petiot, proved to be non-existent. No record survived of his alleged bombing forays, the assassination of Nazis, or tests of his various secret weapons. Prosecutors finally dismissed Petiot's story and charged him with murdering 27 victims for plunder, an estimated 200 million francs in cash, gold, and jewels that were never recovered. Petiot's trial began on March 18, 1946, at the Palais de Justice, before a panel of three judges and a seven-man jury. René Fleuriot once again defended Petiot. Prosecutors were helped by 12 civil lawyers who were hired by the relatives of Petiot's victims. Petiot took an active role in his own defense, bantering with judges and prosecutors, grilling witnesses, exchanging jibes with the private attorneys. He denounced the Caït family's lawyer as a double agent and a defender of Jews, while noting that victim Joseph Réocreux was easy to spot as a collaborator. He had a head like a pimp, you know, like a police inspector. Victim Joachim Gushinov was alive and well, Petiot insisted. Why couldn't prosecutors find him? Because, Petiot smirked, South America is a big place. And so it went. Petiot refused to describe his secret weapons because the information could only be used against France. He dismissed the Wolf family, Dutch Jews fleeing Nazi persecution at home, as Germans, while victim Yvonne Dreyfus was a traitor four times over. Victim Kurt Neller suffered from an embarrassing affliction, which Petiot refused to name, but he and his family had not been killed. They had returned to Germany, Petiot insisted, and were getting ready for the next war. Petiot had met Dr. Paul-Léon Bromberger for 10 minutes in my life at a public luncheon. He could not explain why Bromberger's clothing was found at 21 Rue Le Sueur. Many fugitives had survived the Flytok's escape route, Petiot testified, but none were identifiable because they changed names frequently. Rebuked by the Chief Judge Michel Lessay for doodling in court, Petiot retorted, "I am listening, but it doesn't interest me very much." After the trial's second day, reporters overheard two jurors and Judge Lessay discussing Petiot in private, referring to him as a demon and an appalling murderer. Attorney Floriot immediately sought a mistrial, but the appellate court rejected the motion. The trial resumed after the two offending jurors were replaced. On the trial's fifth day, judges and jurors visited 21 Rue Le Sueur. As he passed through a phalanx of police and jeering neighbors, Petiot quipped, "Peculiar homecoming, don't you think?" Petiot maintained his hero's posture to the end, admitting that he had killed 19 of the 27 victims found on Rue Le Sueur. They were all Germans and collaborators, of course, ranked among the 63 enemies of France, whom Petiot admitted killing between 1940 and 1945. The other 44 were not identified, with Petiot telling the court, "I don't have to justify myself for murders I'm not accused of committing." He had already said more than enough. René Floriot's summation, hailing Petiot as a hero of the resistance, won a standing ovation from the courtroom audience. But the judges and jurors held a very different view. After deliberating for 3 hours, a mere 90 seconds for each of the 135 criminal charges, the court convicted Petiot on all but 9 counts. He was acquitted of killing Nelly Denise Autain, but found guilty of 26 other premeditated murders. Although it did not seem to faze him in the slightest, Petiot's death sentence was a foregone conclusion. Attorney Floriot appealed the conviction and sentence, citing two complaints. First, he maintained that a mistrial should have been granted after Judge Lessay and two jurors publicly declared their belief in Petiot's guilt. Furthermore, Floriot charged, witness Marguerite Bromberger and her maid were perjurers. They lied in maintaining that Dr. Bromberger was dead instead of hiding out in South America. All 3 points were rejected, and Petiot's death sentence was affirmed. The day before that judgment was rendered, guards found an ampoule concealed in Petiot's prison uniform. They suspected it was cyanide, but the contents proved to be a sedative, smuggled into prison when Petiot arrived the previous October. The prisoner seemed calm, smiling as he asked his guards, "When are they going to assassinate me?" He refused to see a priest, preferring, as he said, to take his baggage with him. Petiot had been scheduled to die on the day his appeal was rejected, but the guillotine malfunctioned that morning and his execution was postponed. At 3:30 a.m., May 25th, a portable guillotine was delivered to the prison, assembled and ready to do its grim work less than an hour later. Summoned from his cell, Petiot refused the traditional glass of rum but accepted a cigarette. He also agreed to meet with the prison chaplain for his wife's sake, telling the minister, "I am not a religious man, and my conscience is clean." The closing ritual was swiftly completed. Petiot signed the register before his hands were bound, his neck shaved, and the collar cut from his shirt. He approached the guillotine calmly. Among the witnesses, Dr. Albert Paul noted that Petiot moved with ease, as though he were walking into his office for a routine appointment. Before he was strapped into the guillotine's sliding table, Petiot warned the observers, "Gentlemen, I ask you not to look. This will not be very pretty." The blade dropped at 5:05 a.m. According to the witnesses, Petiot was smiling as his head tumbled into the basket.